You're listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story. From Darwin, Australia, this is your host, Lucy Van Sambeek. Hello and welcome back to Talk the Walk. My guest this week is Tony Woods, who has 9 years' experience in various social work roles here in the Northern Territory. Tony's current role as implementation specialist and practice coach sees her flying up from Canberra to connect with her team on the ground here in Darwin and in Alice Springs in the Intensive Family Support Service project. Prior to that, Tony has worked for many years in remote Aboriginal communities, supporting women and children living with domestic and family violence, project coordination of child-friendly safe houses, and community development with urban Aboriginal school communities around Darwin. Tony has worked alongside Aboriginal people in supervision and management, developing creative, culturally safe educational resources, training and mentoring, project management, counselling and family support. You name it, there's not much Tony hasn't done. Tony will be supporting her good friend and colleague Faye Perryman in presenting their current work with the IFSS project at the 2017 SNAKE Conference in Canberra next week. And I can't wait to hear more about that. So welcome to Talk the Walk, Tony. It's great to be able to have you on the show after all these years.
Thank you very much, Lucy. I feel quite privileged to speak to you and catch up with you, and hopefully we can have a really great conversation.
Great, thank you. I was wondering if we could start by just exploring, how did you come to be practicing social work with Aboriginal communities?
About 15 years ago, I was working in Scotland actually as a rehabilitation worker for guide dogs, and during the course of that training and work, I realised that whilst that was a very specialised qualification, having a social work degree was something that was like a key to unlocking a number of different pathways career-wise. And I wanted to come back to Australia and study rather than do it in Scotland, even though I really love Scotland. So in doing so, I've always had an interest, I guess, in Aboriginal culture and history. And so while I was contemplating, and you know, at the end of my degree, what I was going to be doing, I was always hopefully intending to travel to the Northern Territory or somewhere where I had could have an opportunity to perhaps understand Aboriginal culture a lot more, and you know, if possible, have the opportunity to work with Aboriginal people. Mm. And so I moved to Darwin in the hope of that, and I've been very blessed, to say the least, in what's happened since then.
Mm, and so what did you start off doing when you first arrived in Darwin?
I actually worked for the Department of Defence. They very kindly flew me up there as a social worker to do a locum contract as a new grad. Mm. And whilst I was doing that role, I realised that whilst I learnt a lot in it about working in multidisciplinary teams and how, I guess, some structures work together, I have to be really honest and say it wasn't something I was really passionate about. Mm. And also I think when I was living in Darwin, I just began to see some really huge social injustice and human rights violations that I felt were happening in front of me, in the community as well as just individually, and so I decided to find an organization where I could actually potentially do social work in and amongst all of that, because it was something that I really believed in. And so fortunately I happened to get a job at an organisation that enabled that to happen, and that's when our paths crossed, which I'm very grateful for as well.
So when you started working out in communities, what year was that?
So that would have been 2008. It was during the time of the intervention, so was that 2007? Mm. Yes. It's just prior to the start of the intervention. So I had a period of time of about 4 or 5 months before that happened. So it was really interesting, the difference pre and post Northern Territory, you know, intervention, or the, you know, the emergency response, as some people know.
Mm. And what stands out to you as the biggest memories of that time? Well, you said there was big changes.
I distinctly remember being out at that time. I was working out at Port Keats at Wattair, as some people know it, out in West Arnhem Land, and where about 3,000 people live. And we were pretty much the only support service for families. And at that time, compulsory income management came in, and there were a number of significant numbers of people who suddenly had their payments cut, or what they thought was cut in half, because one half was being controlled by Centrelink and the other part was in their bank account. That happened around the same time as bush holidays. So ordinarily families would have pulled their collective funds together and gone and bought bulk food and provisions and made their vehicles safe, and then gone out to their outstations and spent six or so weeks out there as a family. And of course, when their income became managed, they just didn't have access to those funds. So not only was it distressing because they couldn't go away, a lot of them didn't know what had happened because the information hadn't been shared in language, and huge assumptions had been made by Centrelink about, you know, where the money was going. So it was pretty horrendous. There was people even breaking into the shop and the takeaway to steal food because, I mean, it was pretty extreme. I just really remember that as being quite a critical time. And actually, I got offered a job in unbeknownst to me, while I was at the Department of Defence, I'd applied for a graduate position in the Commonwealth Government through the graduate program, because my boss at the time had suggested that I do that, and I did do that, and I wasn't successful. And then while I was in the middle of this things going on in Wattair, I got a phone call saying that I had been offered a place in the graduate program. Would I like to come and do that for a year, which would have been a fantastic opportunity, because and it was a really big honour to get a space, because there was thousands of people that had applied for it.
Wow.
But I was so fired up by the human rights violations in Wattair that I said no. So I felt like I couldn't leave at that time, because there just didn't seem to be anybody advocating for anyone, and so I just didn't feel like it was great timing to leave. And so I stayed, and subsequently, you know, obviously I'm not working for the Commonwealth Government, and it's just an interesting thing. But that was probably a time when I felt very passionate about things.
And where does this passion for social justice and human rights stem from? Can you pinpoint back in your history? I don't know how long back that might go, but sometimes in childhood people have certain things that happen, and these kind of ethics and values start to become embedded in us. I'm wondering, when that was for you.
It's a really good question, because I probably have never really thought about it. I suppose, I think even when I was really quite young at primary school, I remember when kids were being bullied and stuff, and I was trying to stick up for them. I probably was fairly influenced by my family and, you know, making sure that there was some type of equality and everybody had equal opportunities. It was around the time where Midnight Oil were the band, you know, they're one of my favourite bands, but Midnight Oil 1098 album came out, and it was all about, you know, there was a lot of nuclear things going on, and I started to, you know, probably from about 14, 15, reading socialist magazines and just worried about the nuclear stuff, some other social issues. And so I used to go, when I was old enough, I used to go to rallies in Melbourne when they used to happen, and I loved it. And I think that probably just came from having a family and influenced by the fact that, everybody that I knew as a child probably really felt quite, you know, whether it was subtle or explicit, that everybody needed, you know, should have the same opportunity no matter where you came from, whatever you were doing, and that minority groups in particular deserve the same respect. Yeah, I suppose it's just something it's a good question.
You mentioned family, and I'm wondering if there's any particular people in your family that have inspired you along this direction.
I think that like my mum's a retired nurse, and I remember when the nurses in Melbourne were fighting for wages that were, they were being paid terribly, and there was a massive rally in town, in the city, where you know, thousands of nurses went on strike, and I was able to go into be a part of that rally with her. And I suppose I've always been proud of her for standing up for her rights around that. Yeah, and I think that also probably I was born in Tasmania, you know, understanding a little bit of the Tasmanian history and how Aboriginal people were treated there. You know, I've seen a lot of that in my extended family, some of the stories and that people used to tell me about just how, I don't know, how different parts of society work there. So... And every now and again you meet or you read something. I used to really be a huge fan of John Lennon's as well.
Yes.
And, you know, music, I guess, you know, there's so many political songs and you wonder where it comes from and what that's about. And maybe I was should have been a hippie of some description, but...
If your mum was listening to this conversation we were having right now, what story would she tell me about the way that you enact social justice and human rights in your life now or in your work?
She'd probably tell a story about how I probably throw myself 100% into things that I do, and I don't take no for an answer. and I'm very passionate about individuals having a voice around their own destinies, and I suppose sometimes as a child that's probably where this comes from, because sometimes you feel that you don't have a voice, and I think, you know, like it's not to say that I wasn't able to communicate as a child, but I think that old adage about being seen but not heard is a fairly strong one sometimes, and so I think that she would probably say that I try and help people to have a voice around their own lives as the expert in their own ways of seeing and doing things, and that I throw myself in there and become quite determined about that, often collectively as well as individually, I suppose, championing people.
So it's probably a good point to tell us a little bit about the kind of work that you've been doing over the years and how you might have enacted these values around social justice and human rights over the past 9-10 years. What stands out to you was, I guess, some of the most memorable moments, you felt you really made a difference, I guess.
Well, I think there's been some really great, you know, there's been some extremely challenging times, I think, but sometimes I think those things actually create opportunity for great things to happen. And so, you know, if I'm thinking about Port Keats and following on from that intervention conversation, you know, a lawyer came out, so we were able to organise, you know, some groups of people that would talk to her and capture their stories in order to highlight the concerns that people were having about their financial situation and how that was impacting on their families. I happened to run into the then opposition leader, who was Brendan Nelson at the time, from the Liberal Party, in a local marketplace in Darwin on a Saturday morning while he was doing his walkabout tour. And so I happened to think to myself, I can't just let this opportunity go not to tell him what the result of their policy has been doing in reality. So I exchanged, he was interested, and then he said, I'll give your details to my advisor. And I thought, oh, yeah, he's going to fob me off. But then a few weeks later, you know, I think it was about 3 weeks later, I did get a phone call directly from him.
Wow.
Which I missed a call, but his voicemail was on my phone saying, "Hi Tony, this is Brendan Nelson, the leader of the opposition." And I nearly fell down and fainted because I thought, "My goodness, of all the people in Australia he's got to talk to, why is he ringing me?" You know, but he was really true to his word, so I rang back his office and he wasn't in a meeting. And anyway, I had a bit of a chat to them.
So did you feel like you got a good outcome there? Like, what happened from that conversation?
Well, the funny thing was, I sort of had that became a bit of an ethical dilemma in a funny way, because the advisor sort of said to me, oh, Brendan is really interested, Tony, you know, in some of the comments that you made and wants to connect with some people in Whatair about that. You know, is there anyone in particular that... And so I felt like it really made me think a lot about whose rights are there to sharing stories and who owns those, you know, and where, and that's a continual question. I don't know about you, but I definitely ask that all the time. It's storytelling is a big thing. And so it's sort of like, well, you know, it's not my voice that needs to be heard. However, voices of people also need to be protected and go through the right process to get, you know, get somebody to do that. So I sort of said to them, look, you know, I can have a chat to a few people, and if they feel that they want to talk to you, they can. And I said, I also had found it, and then I also said to them, look, I also find it quite difficult that you're wanting to listen to people who are directly impacted by a government policy, yet you're the ones in this party who implemented it. So how is it that suddenly you're considering what that might look like from a social perspective when you after never considered that when you were exactly. And so that's a bit of a, and then you're going to use that against the current government who have inherited a mess, which sort of seemed a bit just seemed really unethical.
Yeah.
And so I just sort of said, oh, look, you know, I'll have a chat to people. But I didn't follow that through because I thought, you know what, I mean, I did go back to speak to the team that I worked in, and I just said, look, this is, you know, I've sort of had a chat and got this number if anyone wants to ring. But I didn't take it any further personally because I felt that I thought it was a bit unethical.
That's really interesting. I mean, you've talked about having a passion for having people's voices heard and being seen and individuals having a right to their own destinies. And sometimes we have to step in and be advocates for that. And yet you get to a place where, oh, hang on, at what point do people need to speak up for themselves? It's a real hard place to be, isn't it?
It is. And I think that's a dilemma that a lot of social workers face every day in their work. And it's not an easy path to know. But I guess, you know, I was very new to this role. So it was, you know, it was good to be challenged like that. And I think that you can still raise your concerns. But then where it goes after that, I think the people directly impacted are the ones that need to be talking. And sometimes I think that also lessons, like I think as I've got older and a bit wiser about life, I feel that sometimes indirectly by being an advocate, you can rob people of, you think you're doing the right thing, but you're actually robbing them an opportunity to learn something indirectly as well. Like, you know, yeah, the moral of that is, I guess, to think about things as best you can before you do them and how it might be perceived by multiple people, not just because I think sometimes it's easy to get carried away when you're very passionate about something. And obviously, you know, I was very passionate about it then, and I still am, but I, you know, it is tricky. Yeah. And I think though that I just feel there's been lots of highlights for me. And I feel one of the biggest things I think is fantastic is to be involved in projects where you get the opportunity to recruit local community members to projects and to carry out roles that are really integral to the community and help children and their families. And that's always very exciting for me, and that's been a blessing.
So can you speak about a particular piece of work that you've done along those lines that you enjoyed and how you went about doing that?
After I finished working in Port Keats, I got offered a short-term pilot project with Save the Children to work on their school attendance program in urban Aboriginal communities in Darwin, three in particular, and that was connected with three local schools. And it was the first time that the NT Government Department of Education had funded an external non-government agency to run a school attendance project. So it was a fairly high, I suppose, a high-profile investment, if you like. It was only a small bucket of money, and there was a 6-month period to make it work. And so it was an extremely busy 6-month period, luckily, the Save the Children already had, because they provided play schemes to the to those local communities. What they noticed was the number of school-aged children weren't attending school, and they were coming to the play groups. So they felt that there was something that was missing in order to be able to meet the needs of those children and their families, in, you know, to keep them connected to school. So what we did was we came up with a model. I think they'd done some research based on conversations with the communities, and we basically recruited at least one lady, and that, and they were mainly ladies because that's the feedback that we were given from the community, to become what we called a cultural guidance officer, which I really love that job model. And basically their role was to, and they were a very highly regarded, respected person in the community and chosen by the community for that role. So they essentially help families and kids to get up in the mornings to make sure that their needs were met in terms of what they needed for school, to make sure they're on the bus, to help families negotiate and navigate educational systems. These are primary school age children. And one or two of those ladies had never worked before. And we ended up with four cultural guidance officers. We had one community where some of the children went from having sort of 68% of attendance to 95%. We had one little boy in the third, like really the startup of it was the third term. So the fourth term was really the litmus test, if you like, for the how successful it was going to be. You know, because we'd embedded it, took a little while to do that. And then, yeah, and then in the last term, we had one little boy in one community who had I think he'd only been like 55% for the rest of the year, and he was at school 100% in the term four.
Wow.
And we arranged a number of, through the cultural guidance officers, we had community meetings at each place and asked the families what they would really like for their kids, what they would like the school to see the school be doing, and a number of activities came out of that. And one of them was to invite the principal to the community to have a chat about what their worries were for some of the kids that were going to go from grade six to high school, and also they wanted to have a surprise party for the kids at the end of the year to just recognise their attendance. And the party was going to be happening at the community, and they wanted to invite teachers and the principal to the community because everyone always had to go to the school. So that's what happened, and it was just amazing. And there was so many, it was such a, each place was so special. Like you know, there's a few times I've cried in my job. that's probably one of them, just the joy. And there was a lot of teachers who were crying, and the kids were really proud of where they lived, and were showing the teachers their homes. And that project ended up being it ran for, it's only this year that they've just stopped funding that program. So that was that's been running for like, got funded for 8 years.
Wow. So can you speak a bit more about what your role was in that project? What sort of skills and abilities and knowledge you were using, developing within that space? What were you doing exactly?
So my role was to take the everything, basically. To take the you know, obviously you've got, when you've got funding, you've got a specific deliverables. So taking the deliverables and coordinating activities that enable those deliverables to happen. So I suppose I was overseeing the project with a good manager backing me up and providing some guidance. And then, you know, following some recruitment processes again, following the right protocols, community protocols. So having a good understanding of those was really integral to that, and having been able to have conversations with people in the right way so that they understood what their role was and how they could be involved, and not to be worried if they hadn't worked before, because if they were the right person, it was okay. We would work together, and, you know, I would meet with them once or twice a week until they were right. So I mentored them, I suppose. And then we had a weekly team meeting where everybody could get together and they could talk about how they were going at each respective place. Each school was very So I suppose, you know, utilising great communication, having open meetings, involving everybody and being transparent in the project and listening to ideas, really important.
Mm.
And the schools were very receptive to the ideas as well. And so having open pathways with them was really critical. And having principals on board who really embraced the concept was really important as well. Mm. And over that period of that time, you know, two of those ladies ended up basically the schools, two schools ended up employing them on a casual basis to sit in the classroom with children as well. So they extended their employment from a part-time with Save the Children to include hours at the school. And which was fantastic because the kids loved it, and so you know, building up their confidence and being able to, and knowing that they could do those things, really important.
Mm.
And I guess having the right people, I suppose it's about mentoring and bringing people together to find out what's really going on. Because I got shocked at with all due respect to some people in the Department of Education, they did actually say, I heard it on numerous occasions throughout the 6 months, and it used to make me a little bit wild. Mm. They would make comments like, they don't value education, they don't care about education, they don't care about their kids. And this is this big they, and a hell of a lot of judgment and assumptions. And when we actually had meetings with the women, took them, you know, we would grab some food and go to really nice parts of Darwin and sit down in a relaxed way and have really great conversations about what is it that could be different. And there were some really legitimate reasons. So,
and it wasn't that they didn't care about their kids' education at all. It wasn't that.
No, absolutely not. Never even heard anything like that. In fact, it was the opposite. And I feel like that was a really great lesson in terms of hearing the voices. But then I thought, okay, what can we do here? So I asked the ladies, I said, what should we do? What would you like to do with this? This is really important information that you're sharing. And I can't do anything about it. I'm not a school principal. I can't influence. But I said, but we know who the principal is. What if we invite them to come and listen to these worries that you have? And they said, oh, yeah, you know, you can invite them. You can invite the principal. And I said, well, where can we meet? And they said, we'll meet in the community. And so the principal came down to the community hall. There was about 15 women there. And I said, you know, before the principal arrived, I was like, you know, yeah, you're going to talk to him, you know, if he comes down. They said, yeah, no worries, we'll talk to him, don't worry. And of course, he was 6'3" and sat in the middle of the chair in the hall. and the other ladies were sitting there, and it was stone. It was just quiet, really quiet, gosh. Really quiet. And then we just started just generally talking about some of the fun, you know, fun things at school. And then all of a sudden, the ladies were there, and he only had like half an hour. And he ended up staying for like an hour and a quarter, listen, and really actively listened, which is fantastic.
Mm. Did you play much of a role there in facilitating that conversation?
Yes, I did, in terms of making everybody feel comfortable enough to be able to talk, and then I guess making sure that everybody's voice was being heard, because what can happen sometimes is, you know, there's one or two that may dominate the group, and the one or two quiet ones actually have really important points to make. So I suppose just capturing, making sure that everyone felt that they'd had an opportunity. And that if I think it's really important as a facilitator as well, to just take note of any things that are going to come out of that, and making sure that we followed up with those things. And I think that's a critical aspect of being the project coordinator, is following up with things, you know, with actions.
Oh, that's a great example of a piece of work that, yeah, I can really just picture in my mind you sitting amongst all those women and this principal who was white, I gather.
Yes.
Yeah, in the middle of a community. It just, yeah, it really took me there, and I can appreciate the beauty in that piece of work. I'm wondering if we can go back to, you've already shared some of the struggles or challenges that you've had along the way, but also what opportunities that came out of that for you. And I'm wondering if you could share perhaps some other challenges that you've come across on your journey, and perhaps some of the ones that still niggle today even.
Now, Lucy, I've done a lot of healing about these ones that still niggle a little bit. But, no, I think that what I've realised is it's been fantastic, actually, the last few years. I've been working for an organisation called the Parenting Research Centre, and my role sounds very flash, but it's implementation specialist. But in learning that role, which is primarily a practice coach and helping organisations to implement a program using a model of implementation that comes from the National Implementation Research Network in America,
mm-hmm.
and by a gentleman called Dean Fixon. He designed that based on a whole lot of research on what works well in implementation. And it's a very good model. There's a number of models, but this one's a pretty good one. What I've realised is that many of the challenges that I've had in projects, because I've primarily been involved in projects, have fallen down in the implementation. So, the Child Friendly Safe House project was a fantastic opportunity to really, and I was working with Faye on that as well, a really fantastic opportunity for the government, the NT government, to influence how children were seen and accepted and respected and honoured in remote safe houses across the Northern Territory that were funded through the Commonwealth Government.
Mm-hmm.
So, we worked really hard for 10 months coming up with all of these amazing resources and ideas which had come from the ground. We went and saw, pretty much about, the majority of safe houses in the Northern Territory. Had some really fantastic conversations with people who actually worked directly with women and children,
mm.
and were guided by all of that, came up with these amazing things, and then it was pretty much vetoed by the management of that project at the government level, and none of it was implemented. Now, that to me is still one that eats away a little bit, and the other thing about that was that I do my best not to be a seagull, and I... by going and actually having real conversations with people, the least you can do is go back and share with them what's come out of that story and how it's informed some practices or ways of doing things that could make things better for other families. And that's to me, is the least you can do. And that's the way I practice. I do my best to practice like that. And so the manager also blocked the information going to the people who had provided that to us, so they didn't even know what the outcomes were, and they probably thought that we were just went there, took their stories and left, So I did my best to make a concerted effort behind the scenes to ensure that that didn't happen, and so I had to privately arrange for the information to be fed back. So, that is all about implementation. So when I think about that example, what I've learned from that, and I would really encourage people to really think about this when they are doing something new or at any stage of a project, is to really consider, is the organisation who's asking for something in particular to be developed really ready for it? Because if I'd have done a readiness assessment of the NT government and the team structure and format at that time, the answer would have been no, and there would have had to have been a lot of work done prior to anything starting, and then there may have been a better outcome. So I learned a very valuable lesson, a number of lessons out of that project, and so yeah, that's probably been a challenge. And of course, I think that there's a lot of challenges when I'm working in a project where you're funded by the Commonwealth Government, but you've got a competing project that's or similar program that's been funded by the NT government. To me, the biggest challenges are structural and systemic factors. They're the biggest challenges I face, I think.
Tell me a little bit about the Parenting Resource Centre that you work for. How is your project funded?
So the Parenting Research Centre is an organisation that is a few different arms. Its head office is based in Melbourne, and it's been around for a very long time. It's a not-for-profit organisation that essentially look at the latest and best evidence, if you like, in terms of parenting that will help families to be able to raise their children and give their children the best possible start. So there's a lot of research out there about what makes for effective parenting, what helps kids grow, what can the caregivers do that give them the best possible start. And it's very scientific, and some of it is very hard to understand, and it takes a long time, and not everybody has time to read mega amounts of research. So the parenting research take that information and do like knowledge, what they call knowledge synthesis. So they take that information and translate it into products and programs that can then be available to assist practitioners or families to use the information so that they can get the best out of it. So one of the things that the Parenting Research Centre have is, you may have seen it, and I would highly recommend it to all social workers who work with families, or is the Raising Children Network. That is an amazing resource of information that, you know, there's a dedicated team that are continually updating that with the latest and greatest and coming up with ways in which presenting information that can help all sorts of families. It goes all across the developmental stages of you know, a child's journey, right from, you know, pregnancy right through to teenagers. It's got videos on there. There are lots of things on there. So that's one thing that the Parenting Research Centre do. So the Intensive Family Support Service that I work with is funded by the Commonwealth Government, and that came out of the Growing Them Strong Together report following some coronials in the Northern Territory, and the fact that there just wasn't enough programs for families to early intervention and prevention programs in relation to supporting families to overcome barriers to their parenting, which was potentially leading to risk of children becoming neglected.
I was just going to say, Parenting Research Centre, it sounds like a great resource, like you said. How do you take those kinds of resources and make them applicable in Aboriginal communities? I imagine that's going to be a big answer, probably. But in practical terms, what are the ways forward that you've been able to develop so that these kind of resources are culturally safe in communities?
Sure. So I, like, the Raising Children Network team, which I'm not a part of, but I do provide some advice to them every now and again. They generally take a theme of parenting and will approach a local organisation, a local Aboriginal organisation, and a number of stakeholders who they would consider to be cultural experts from different Aboriginal groups across different locations in Australia, and ask them for feedback about how they believe information can be best presented. The information would then be put together and tested, if you like, with an audience, and then if it was a, you know, acceptable, I suppose, then it gets uploaded to the Raising Children Network site. So we have organisationally a Reconciliation Action Plan, and one of the actions we've included in there is doing our best to ensure in whatever project you're attached to, if you like, that you're going to do your best to make sure that the information is culturally safe and appropriate and sensitive. And the only people that can really sort of provide an okay on that are Aboriginal people.
Okay.
That's what we do. So, but the interesting thing is, this actually leads into very nicely into what we're talking about at the SNAKE conference, because
and tell us about what you and Faye will be presenting there.
It's very nice lead-in. So what happened when Faye and I started, that's actually an interesting journey in itself, because I've been working with Faye now for six years or 7 years or something. And when we joined the Parenting Research Centre, we actually looked for a job for two people. It was the first time ever in my life I've ever tried to find a job for a team rather than one person. So they took us both, and because we'd been doing a lot of cross-cultural work together, and we had a solid team, we felt we had unfinished business. And so when we joined the Intensive Family Support Service, a lot of the materials were developed in Melbourne, and there weren't, and the people in Melbourne, with all due respect to them, had not really worked or travelled or lived or been in an Aboriginal community, and so they really missed the beat. They were really, the information was important, but the style in which they presented and the context in which they were done was really, it could have been better. So, and my colleague Faye, I kept saying to her, you know, you have to read the program guide, read the program guide. And she put it, she would put it off and put it off, because Faye, bless her, was part of the, grew up on a mission and was part of the stolen generation.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't, she learned to read at the age of 30, which I find amazing. She's just a remarkable woman, right? So for her to read this program guide was a really significant thing. But anyway, I said to her, I kept beating on the drum going, you got to read it, you got to read it. Anyway, so she basically read it. She read it. And then overnight she had like a visit from a dream, a really powerful dream. And the old people in the dream showed her this painting and a way, a special magic way of translating that program guide into a tool, resource. And so, you know, she rang me the next day and she's going, oh, you've got to come and see me. I've started this. And and so I went round to see her, and then she had this massive, I mean, I've seen a lot of her paintings because she's a really, really great artist.
Mm-hmm.
But this was massive compared to ones that I'd seen before, and nothing like what I'd seen her do before. And she was just so into it. So anyway, watch this. She had it all in her head, all the layers and everything else like that. And in the previous project, we'd sort of done some stuff around systems, ecological systems type pictures and thinking about that. And anyway, in the yarning mat was very much around having the child at the centre of the conversation. And it basically is like, if you were looking at it from a theoretical point of view, you might say it's an ecological systems theory, but it's a child at the centre, and then the family, extended family, community, and then the further circle out is external people, which could include visitors to the community, for example, or stakeholders that come in and provide a service. And then she's divided that into five sections which match the developmental domains of childhood, which we talk to when we do our training in the intensive family support, which are primarily things like health, physical care, warm and responsive parenting, learning, education and learning, and then we've got pictures that match each of those domains broken down. So for example, for health, it would be, you know, dental checks, immunisation, regular going when there's a problem, if someone's had an accident or something, and then ways, story cards, if you like, ways of working with the yarning mat to be able to have a conversation about quite difficult things which relate to the child. And so that's essentially the resource. And on top of that, she's designed, so the base mat is obviously, you can tell multiple stories using that alone. And then alongside that are three spirit circles, and the white spirit circle talks about is the strengths of the family and the things that are going well for the family in that area, whatever they're talking about. The yellow one is for any worries that they may have, and the red one is for big troubles. And you can put the smaller circles in the center and have a yarn about that. So you're going to start always with the strengths that people have. And then sometimes, you know, they'll tell you that they have worries about something. And we took this tool out to, so we worked in collaboration together about, so I sort of applied, like, we can do it, you can do a eco map on it, you can do a genogram. So I sort of, I suppose the involvement I've had with it is A, supporting Faye to make it come to life, and encouraging her, and also then just talking about how some of the theory could be applied to it, and turning that into some activities. And then we took it to Maningrida, to some old women there who we trusted, and they had a look at it. And since then, it's been on a journey itself. So And from that feedback, you know, we sort of said, because people when they are, you know, we were like, what do we call this red one with the, you know, where it's quite a serious risk or of mm-hmm. harm and things aren't going so great. And they were like, you know, well, we normally call people who are doing things in that realm troubled people. So we'll call that, that's why we called that the troubles, mm-hmm. big troubles, the red one. And we took the feedback and then, yeah, it became now the pack has become quite very professional, and Faye does the training and goes out with practitioners and follows them up with coaching, because that's an implementation measure that we know that training, mm. pretty much training alone is not enough sometimes for people to really understand and implement something that's new. So that's what the Yarning Mat is, and we've had some magic stories. It talks to people in different ways, and for some people it's not something that they have to use in their work, but for those that are interested and really want to get into it, like it speaks to you. And so we've designed it so you can do engagement assessment, action planning, working with the family on what the referral concerns are, choosing the priority at the time, exit case closure. You can talk about, you know, you can find out who's in the family and do an eco map on there to work out where their supports are, how they're feeling about those. You can do lots of things. And one particular story of a lady that we met who, when I first met her anyway, she was pretty much homeless, living in a tent in a remote area with three children, and had been through significant domestic and family violence and actually had committed assault herself because in retaliation and self-defense, things weren't great for her at all. And during the course of the worker was learning how to use a yarning mat, and during the course of that work with that lady over a 12-month period, she would ask for the mat to come out each time, and the transformation and the stories, it was really incredible. And I know that, you know, you and I both resonate very strongly with narrative therapy and externalization of stories, of difficult things to talk about. It's a really good example of that, the yarning mat, because I think people, especially when it comes to talking about child neglect and I mean, we don't really use that word. We're very strength-based when it comes to talking about it. But at the end of the day, when you're talking about child protection matters, it's a very safe way of doing that.
Oh,
and
wow,
so this
wonderful.
Is quite exciting. Yeah, so Faye and I went to when we went to the Snake Conference in Cairns, which was like, 4 years ago. And we said, we were listening to the speakers and we're going, we could get up there and talk about stuff.
Yeah.
And
you will be next week.
And exactly, so dreams can come true. So, yeah.
So if people want to find out more about it, is there a place they could do that?
Yeah, so the resource, the history of it, it is been recorded in a little video, which is available on, I think it's www.ifs.net.au. And that's the website for the Intensive Family Support Program across the Northern Territory. And there is a short video on there, about 6 minutes of Faye discussing how it came about and her background and story. And I would really highly recommend it. The first time I saw it, I bawled my eyes out. I still get very emotional when I see it.
Great. So we'll put a link up on our show notes to that, so people want to follow up with that.
Yeah, last year Faye spoke at the Australian Implementation Conference, which is an international conference, and gave a talk about the yarning mat, because it is actually an awesome example of knowledge translation and exchange, and how you take something from one aspect and convert it into a user-friendly, accessible, honouring, respectful resource. Fantastic. Yeah, I'm really happy to be standing beside her next week while she talks about this, and I'm so excited to see where it goes, because I really hope that my hope for her is that it launches her, you know, this aspect of her life. She's created some amazing resources in the past, which I hope that she can bring together and really help other children, because she never wanted children to have to go through what she did. And I think, yeah, it's very powerful. So
I'm aware we're approaching the hour, but I really wanted to just ask you a question about your relationship with Faye, because I know that a lot of work has been done the two of you together, and that doesn't just happen overnight. And I'm wondering, you talked before about being a solid team and that you had unfinished business, and I just want to know, is there any business that's still unfinished? And also, there's probably two questions here, but how do you get to become such close colleagues and do this kind of work together?
Oh, great questions, great questions. And we actually get asked this a fair bit. We sort of just forget about it, and it's interesting how people make observations when they see us working together, and they're like, "And how did you get that to happen? And how long has it been? How did you get into the groove like that?" And I would say, first of all, it involved a lot of travelling and bush trips, mm-hmm. where you're stuck in the car with someone for 8 hours, and you have to get to know one another and trust one another, because you're relying on one another. I think that we had to go to some really remote areas and rely on open communication with each other, because, you know, things can go a bit wrong when you're driving or whatever it might be. And I think Faye always talks about the fact that when I started, I mean, I was really she's a very strong woman, so I was really nervous, and she was really tough nut to crack. And she often talks about how she said, "Oh, when Tony came to the thing, I just thought, oh no, here we go, another one, you know, another person." And then she said, "But," and we knew we were going to be paired off. So she was very skeptical about me. And then she said that like, I had some really big ideas about how to do things because I was super excited. And but I made sure, like, everything I did, I asked her opinion, and I asked her what she thought, and I really listened, and I said, "What do you think is going to help, and how are we going to do that together, and what is it going to look like?" And I think she, over time, she realised that I was genuine about that, and likewise, you know, I really had to listen about, because she's a cultural expert, and I had to really listen that other ways. So look, we've had our ups and downs, but I think that it all comes down to honouring and respecting each way. And I think we've always been really, we've complemented, like, the cultural aspects with the theoretical aspects. And I think that we what we seem to do when we go to places, we don't always get it right, but when we seem to be able to model two-way working, that's something that we're very passionate about, is helping people to see that it's possible and it's very easy, and it's actually very rewarding, and greatness can come of it. And it just means embracing one another's journey and respecting that. But really, I don't know how you could work in any other way in this context. And in fact, I think it probably could be a good thing to write about, because for those of us that do it, it's not easy. It can be very frustrating for both parties at different times for different reasons.
So is that what you mean by unfinished business? You're going to write something together?
So unfinished business, I guess we could write something together. And depending, we're waiting to hear what funding we've got going forward and how that could have a significant impact on us in the next week or two.
Oh, right.
So that's why I really am optimistic and hopeful that for Faye it's a launch of it's whatever the outcome of our funding arrangements, I'm really hoping that next week is a launch of her business and as a consultant. And as for me, I guess hopefully we'll continue to work together. I feel like we do things apart and we come together, and then we're, you know, so I trust the universal about that. I can't think of a better experience in my life than having had the opportunity to work with Faye, really, and many of the other elders and past colleagues I've had and current colleagues who are just amazing men and women, and really that has made me a much better person. I think, apart from being a professional as a person, I feel spiritually I'm a lot better person for that. So whatever I do, I try and remember that there's hundreds of people that stand behind me that I've had the privilege of listening to that influence the little spark in me. So
great. Thank you so much, Tony, for giving us an hour of your time on this Monday evening. And Yeah, I hope you've enjoyed this look back at the past 10 years as much as I've enjoyed listening to it. It's been a beautiful, beautiful reflection, and I really appreciate everything that you shared with us and the little take-home messages along the way that, I'm sure we can all benefit from. So thank you again.
Thank you very much, Lucy, for inviting me to talk. It's been, I really feel very blessed, actually, because I was saying to you earlier that tomorrow is my birthday, and which is a Tuesday, and sometimes you get reflective about all parts of your life, especially when you start to get white hairs and you're thinking about things. And so I'm so grateful for this opportunity, because I realize all the amazing things that have happened and what I'm still passionate about. And I really hope that if anyone wants, I'm happy to share any links and information that I may have touched on that could help other people. And
that would be great. And if there's a way of people connecting with you, either online or in person, is there a way that people can do that?
Yeah, sure. Like, I'm happy to provide my email address and, you know, some other contact details if anyone would like to have a chat to me.
You on LinkedIn or?
I am on LinkedIn. I'm still trying to get my head around how to use it, but by all means, yes, I am on LinkedIn. Yeah, if there's anything that I could talk to someone about, or they want to have a yarn about something that might be beneficial, then by all means.
They might even be able to hook up with you in person at the Snake Conference if they're planning to go, and which is where I'm heading to next week, and I'm really looking forward to catching up with you face-to-face.
Absolutely. That'd be great. But, thank you very much, everybody, and I wish you a fantastic week. Thanks very much for the opportunity, Lucy.
Great. Thanks again, Tony. Bye.
No worries. See ya.
Thanks for listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story, music by Flashback Digital. You can access all the show notes from today's podcast at www.metaphoricallyspeaking.com.au. I'm currently on the lookout for inspiring interviewees. If you or someone you know is walking the talk in their work or community, then I'd love to hear from you. You can drop me an email at lucy@metaphoricallyspeaking.com.au or visit my contact page on the Metaphorically Speaking website. Until next time, just keep on walking.